I live the life I deserve. Bless. A vacay, I feel better at work. I mean, whatever it's worth.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your top line of music criticism and cultural listing. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
Blessings on blessings on blessings. Look at my life, man, that's lessons on lessons on lessons. I treat the beat like it's a reverend. I tell the truth like, Father, forgive me. These are all my confessions, man. This wasn't luck, it was destined. I done lost homies who've been with me since Ed, and Eddie, who flipped like confetti.
Today, as we draw closer to the end of the year, 2015, we're going to talk about the greatest songs of the last 12 months. Not albums, not concepts.
but the merest niblets of musical information.
But songs. John Caramonica, let's start with you. What was the top of your list?
I, as a person, live the life I deserve. So I picked Blessings by Big Sean, Drake, and Kanye West. There was like a moment a few years ago.
This song deserved you?
I definitely deserve this song. Let's start with that. There was a moment a few years ago when there was just a lot of these guys getting on each other's records, and this is sort of like the kind of like logical conclusion of this. It's actually a very, very uplifting record. It's Kanye rapping about the education of his daughter. There's just a lot of beautiful things on this record, and I feel like everybody really brought their A game, even Big Sean. I never thought I would see the day where the name Big Sean was next to the number one on any, maybe like number like 107 or like 143, but not one on any list of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But Blessings is just that good.
John Pareles, what was important on your list? Doesn't have to be number one, but something that maybe is secretly number one for you.
Well, the one on the top of the list is Skrillex and Diplo with Justin Bieber, Where Are You with an umlaut now.
Where are you now?
Yes. Thank you for the pronunciation guide.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of avant-garde-ness that slipped onto the radio because of Justin Bieber. It doesn't have a chorus, which is kind of cute for a radio hit. It's mostly these weird electronic sounds. It's got a tiny bit of melody, and it's got the secret sound, which is the little snippet of squiggle of sound that happens to be Justin Bieber's voice. So I think it secretly attacks some primordial part of your brain because there's still a human voice in there, even though it sounds like a little synthesizer. So I think it's kind of an ingenious song. I wouldn't say it has the greatest melody and lyrics of all time in the old words and music kind of songwriting, but as a 3-minute slice of musical experience, it's kind of fascinating.
Where are you now?
Where are you now?
Where are you now that I need you? Couldn't find you anywhere. When you broke down, I didn't leave you. Oh, I was by your side. So where are you now that I need you? Oh, where are you now that I need you?
Nate Chenin, what stands out on your list?
Well, my number one is Kendrick Lamar's All Right, and we've talked about this song, and we've talked about Kendrick in podcasts of the recent time frame. So I'm going to sort of pivot to my number two, which is a track called I Know There's Going to Be Good Times, something connecting this song to Blessings, I suppose. It's by the producer Jamie XX, and it features Young Thug and Popcorn, and it's a standout track on Jamie XX's album, In Color. The album itself is, you know, it points to sort of 90s rave culture. It has a lot of that sort of spirit in it. It's sort of a nostalgic record in a certain way, but not suffocatingly so. You know, like it feels very fresh. But this is the track on this album that really sort of stands out as a single. And it also is the one that feels the most sort of 2015. You know, like it's a Young Thug moment, a track that really belongs to him. I just never got tired of it.
What about you, Ben Ratliff?
I'm going to do a green screen mashup of two songs.
Wow.
If you can imagine that, of Drake's Hotline Bling and Colleen Green's Pay Attention. Mm. I don't know. I thought a lot about paying attention this year, both in terms of songs or records that took a long time to unfold or that contained a lot, and also just the amount of attention that we bring to bear on a song like Hotline Bling when our first instinct is to interact with it. Well, the Colleen Green song, Pay Attention, I found sort of amazing because I could be completely misreading what she was trying to do. She might have just been trying to create a cool, tight song. But the narrator of the song, in effect, she's saying, I'm sorry, but I can't hear anything you're saying because I just can't pay attention. Like, you can keep talking as long as you want, but I just can't do it. The way that she says words like attention and affliction, she pronounces them wrong. She says attention, affliction. It's as if she's hearing the song, she's hearing words from the guy talking to her, but she's hearing them wrong because she has, you know, an attention disorder or something. She's hearing them fractured or fragmented. It just seemed like this bit of genius to me. Also, the fact that it's a song all about not being able to focus, and it's an incredibly focused song. Everybody's heard Hotline Bling, so we'll hear a little bit of Colleen Green's Pay Attention.
Ben, can you talk to me a little bit, please, about Karen Clark Sheard, Sunday AM?
Karen Clark Sheard is a member of the Clark Sisters and has been performing with them since she was really young, 1970, I think. This song, Sunday AM, is from a new record she made called Destined to Win, a live in the church record like lots of gospel records are. They found a slow groove that was transcendent to me. Just all over this record, this album Destined to Win, there's examples of real excellence in terms of, like, here's a type of a song and we're just going to destroy it. I mean, there's like, you know, three or four types. They do each one excellently. This is the slow groove.
Thank you for that.
Let worship usher me on Sunday morning, can I talk to somebody out there about Sunday morning?
So, John, let me ask you a question.
Oh, my.
And I say this with the deepest of respect, but why?
That seems dubious.
But why is Shawn Mendes on your list with Stitches, which rhymes kisses with stitches?
Yo, first of all, why isn't Shawn Mendes on your list? Like, let's just be about that. Let's be about that life. The reason that I gravitated to this song was because when I first heard it, I didn't know Shawn Mendes sung it. If I'm being honest, I might have slightly discounted it if I had known that right off the rip. But I heard it on the radio. I like that it, okay, the sort of closest analog that I can come up with from this year were the Nick Jonas solo songs, which feel very, very produced and genre-specific, like very targeted. And when I heard this on the radio, it felt like a song that was homeless to me. It's sort of a high-energy pop song, but it's also sort of an acoustic guitar hand-clappy song. It's basically like Ed Sheeran in Tiger Beat, kind of. You know, it has like a little bit of like a slight frenzy in some of the better One Direction songs, and it has a little bit of that frenzy to it. And Shawn Mendes is a kid who, you know, has had like, you know, his Vines are fine. His prior singles and EP or whatever, they were fine. But there was something that I thought was very smartly underproduced about this record. And so I'm not going to keep that man off my list, that boy, just because he's Shawn Mendes.
We'll take it under consideration.
Boom.
You watch me bleed until I can't breathe. Shaking body onto my knees. And now that I'm without your kisses, I'll be needing stitches. Tripping over myself. Aching, begging you to come out. And now that I'm without your kisses, I'll be needing stitches. Just like a moth drawn to a flame.
Okay, John Pareles, in looking at your list, there's like a little click hanging out at the cool kids table that that stuck out to me. So I'm going to ask you about three tracks that are adjacent. One is Unapologetic Bitch by Madonna. Maybe you've heard of her. Then there's a track by Sophie called Vizy. And then you have Boots, I Run Roulette. And it struck me that these three tracks kind of have, there's some sort of cohesion among them.
I don't know. You may be seeing more coherence than I envisioned. The Madonna track is just an example of her great pop sense, which is to say the phrase unapologetic bitch, a four-syllable word and a one-syllable word, but it sings itself. And the track she got out of Diplo and half a dozen other producers is a reggae song. The verses are kind of pretty nasty about the ex that she's talking about, but you can just see unapologetic bitch emblazoned on T-shirts from now until eternity. It's just Madonna is a great self-brander, and that song continues the tradition of figuring out the perfect little short phrase that everybody is going to take to heart. So that's why that one's there. The Sophie one is there because it is just this. Sophie's a producer. He's a guy. The vocal on the song is a high-voiced woman who is probably saying, we can go crazy and go pop, which is a phrase I like. And the song goes crazy and goes pop by being incredibly sparse, but by having a lot going on. There's a lot of strange synthesizer syncopations. It's as terse and compressed as you can get. And I just think it's a little funhouse of a song. The third one about which you inquired is by Boots, who was the secret closer on the Beyoncé album. But his own stuff is this weird, pressured, paranoid stuff. He's also a minimalist. Throughout his album, there are only three instruments heard at any given time, which is kind of a stunt. This song manages to be strange and unsettling and also have a pretty chorus. So I gave it up to Boots.
Nate Chenin, on your list is David Bowie's Black Star, which was kind of a weird moment when that arrived out of nowhere.
It was.
What was your first response to that song? And is it the same response that you have now?
Well, there's a sort of a shock value to the video, I think. And, you know, that was how most of us,
I think,
how
we all heard it.
Yeah, it was like it just came out of nowhere. You know, the sort of alienating aspects of that video, I think at this point I can divorce them from the impact of the song itself. It's a weird song too, you know, and it involves musicians that we know and cover in our capacities as jazz critics, mm-hmm. basically the Donny McCaslin Quartet with Mark Giuliano on drums and Jason Lindner on keyboards. But what they're doing on this track is really interesting. You know, it's like he gave them full license to just bang this thing out. It's, you know, the track I think is what, like 8 minutes or something. It has this brooding kind of cadence that then suddenly shifts into a slower, more almost soul related stomping thing. And so it's a song that morphs, like itself, the form is unstable. And then there's just a lot that happens, a lot that's compressed into it in terms of what the musicians are playing from measure to measure. I think the drum part itself is you know, you could just focus on that and have like this really interesting experience. It's on there because I'm still intrigued by it. I haven't quite been able to resolve what this track is about. And I find that really sort of intoxicating.
Probably the longest song on any of our lists.
Probably, yeah.
Definitely top 40 bound.
Yeah. and that album's coming soon, you know, and I think we've all maybe heard a little bit of it, or maybe all of it. And this was like, you know, the fact that this is the one, you know, it's the title track of the album, but the fact that this is the one that leads, you know, it's the lead single, is also interesting. Like, he didn't go with the pop hit.
In the villa of all men. In the villa of all men. Stands a solitary candle. At the center of it all. At the center of it all.
Now that we've all interrogated each other, can I make a confession?
Do you want a lawyer?
A true confession?
Possibly. Here's the thing. I have a sort of a rule that if a song appears on an album that is in my top 10 albums list, then I do not put it on my songs list.
Mm-hmm.
And this is strange because it's sort of a strategic thing in the sense of, should I put Future's commas on my song list when I have Future's album, which implicitly includes commas, already on my albums list?
Mm.
But I do that because I want to put other voices and other names on my list. And I think sometimes there are people whose approach to singles is very different than their approach to albums. There are legitimate reasons for this and maybe illegitimate reasons for this. But when I look at my songs list and I don't see any Weekend singles, I know that that's not a completely accurate representation of my personal year in singles.
But you don't have to worry because I put a Weekend single in my list. But the same thing, I was thinking about the Weekend album or the single, and I refuse to overlap too.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if you're talking about the best songs of the year, some of them may well be on the best albums of the year.
When did you develop that rule? Because I sort of just intuited my way to it a few years ago.
I think it was around the dawn of recorded time.
Okay. Do either of you guys have that approach?
I'm not dogmatic with that rule, although okay. That's a part of it. I guess maybe the best way to put it is that that's a consideration, but there are exceptions. So All Right is my top single because that song meant something very specific and important to me this year, and the album meant something related, but it had a different sort of center of gravity somehow.
Okay.
And that's the only overlap in my case. There's a slightly different sort of philosophy of the songs list, which is that this is in many cases a place for me to acknowledge, like, this is the song that jumps out on an album that didn't quite make my albums list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Chris Stapleton is a good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you know, Jason Isbell,
mm-hmm.
an album that I admired but didn't put on my list.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, you really want an album to work pretty much end to end,
right?
And you want the songs to add up to more.
Yeah, it ends up really being a referendum on, like, what did you succeed at as an artist? Like, did you succeed at making a good? This is like the Carly Rae Jepsen conundrum, right? Like, I actually quite like the Carly Rae Jepsen album. I didn't like it as much as these other records that I put on my album list, but when I listened back to it the other day, I was like, okay, what she's succeeding at is playing the role of a blank for 3.5 minutes or 4 minutes, more than she's succeeding at being an album artist.
That's right. I mean, I think that record is pretty good too, but I enjoyed those songs as singles more.
Discreet.
Yeah. I do listen to albums. Like, that's how I listen at home.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to an album. And Carly
John's Rae, on constant shuffle, by
yeah,
the way.
I don't know what that means.
Carly Rae Jepsen's album, it's too much fun. It's too much excitement. I can't take it.
It's too much fun in a row.
You know, the way I listen to music is 40 or 45 minutes at a stretch. I can't take that much intensity. So it's better for me to hear just that one song and then press stop, which is basically the definition of a single.
That is the best review of the Carly Rae Jepsen album that anyone has done, myself included.
Ben Ratliff, quote, too much fun.
Are there any other albums that were too much fun for you in 2015?
Nothing else great comes to mind.
No, but you don't want to eat the whole box of candy. Right?
I personally, but... So are you sort of privileging fun in the singles universe, whereas you privilege complexity in the album universe?
Listening to the entire Carly Rae Jepsen record is the equivalent of hearing, you know, a triple album by somebody who doesn't pack as much pop intensity into every second.
Some would argue
that that's a plus.
That's a win. It's a win for youth. It's a win for attitude. It's a win for fun.
Why bring youth into the discussion?
Carly Rae is listening to this and getting T-Bone Burnett on the phone and saying, I've got to win.
Listen,
Ben Ratliff.
The more we can confuse Carly Rae Jepsen in this conversation, the better.
Shouts to Carly Rae Jepsen.
There's things that she has yet to learn.
Extremely presumptuous. I don't presume to know the full extent of Carly Rae Jepsen's knowledge. And actually, I think one of the takeaways from this album was that Carly Rae Jepsen knows things that I did not think she knew. How to sing in a wide variety of styles. Mm-hmm. I felt like... you know, I think like the sort of thing about this, that record in particular was, this is her hipster record, basically. Mm-hmm. This is the cool record, but it's also the Quiet Storm record. And it's also the sort of like slow burn. Like it's about four different records and she's pretty good at all of them. That's something that's useful to know. And you wouldn't have known from her first album.
John, Caramonica, and the rest of you too, maybe we can ask the same question about Fetty Wap. Trap Queen really is a song from 2014 that just gained unbelievable traction this year. But then there were other singles this year as well, and an album.
Yes, there was an album, not it's sort of an afterthought album. I mean, this is Trap Queen was popular for easily 9 months before that record came out. It was almost like country time and how that record came. You know, in Nashville, it's like we're working the fourth single, and then finally it's like, and now the Chris Young record's dropping. But that doesn't happen in hip-hop that much. And it's strange because when you listen to the Fetty Wap album, it's basically just Trap Queen and like 16 other songs that sound a tremendous amount like Trap Queen. So you would think that wouldn't have taken that long to pull together,
right?
All things told.
He actually threw out 400 other songs.
Yes. There's a zip file somewhere of 400 other Trap Queen-esque songs.
But is there any level on which it works as an album?
It was too much fun.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that was the problem with it until just now.
Was it too much fun?
It was too much. Well, it was too much of whatever the thing is.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the Fetty thing is, it was too on the nose.
Well, wasn't it diminishing returns if you got...
I wouldn't say that, because an interesting thing about Fetty Wap is there's something almost ahistorical about his records. Like, you can just sort of listen to Again or My Way and just be like, no, this is the most important Fetty Wap. And because they all sort of trigger the exact same function or the exact same pleasure centers. I personally have not had diminishing returns with Fetty Wap. I like each individual Fetty Wap song roughly the amount I liked it when I first heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's strange. And I don't know if that's something to do with like the technological things that they put on his voice, or if it's just that, I don't know, I have no imagination. I can't tell. But I do feel like his songs function in a very Sugar Rush-y kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I did find listening to 17 of them back to back not a totally satisfying experience.
Are you a live for the moment kind of person?
Can you be more specific? I think that's your answer right there. When it comes to Fetty Wap, yes. It's a strange time for hip-hop singles, especially in the sort of space, the crossover space between hip-hop and pop. 2 or 3 years ago, you'd have guys like Flo Rida or Pitbull. You know, they're rappers, but like it's not like rap radio plays Flo Rida. Like, Flo Rida basically completely existed to make club-oriented pop rap that, like, Z100 would play. But it's not like Hot 97 would play it. Fetty somehow bridged those two worlds and, like, united them, which is a great thing for Fetty Wap. Maybe not a great thing for the center of hip-hop, because the center of hip-hop is, like, just being yanked closer and closer to pop, and it's harder to differentiate. Certainly, I mean, Fetty, I mean, I said this in my thing. It's like he had five top 40 hits this year, or five top 20 hits or something. I mean, this guy basically, sui generis, made his own genre out of whole cloth.
Mm-hmm. And when you want that thing, you go to him.
Yeah, and there's no one else for it. Yeah, and he's not maligned in the same way that like, people used to malign Flo Rida, or people used to malign Pitbull, and still do, unfairly. But you don't really have people maligning Fetty in that same exact way.
Nobody had El Taxi on the list.
True. No one had Ginza on the list.
I was thinking of making a list of like songs that brilliantly inhabit other songs, such as Pitbull's El Taxi, which inhabits Murder, She Wrote, mm-hmm. such as Drake's Hotline Bling.
Yeah, depending who you ask.
Inhabits.
Drums Cha-Cha.
Drums Cha-Cha.
I thought there were some songs this year that did that badly. Was it Natalia LaRose or Natalie LaRose who did the Whitney Houston thing? She like sort of remade a Whitney Houston song, and it's very popular, but it's also very unimaginative. I think Tory Lanez has an SWV bite. That's basically the only reason I know who Tory Lanez is. Mm-hmm. The idea of the interpolation is not necessarily a new one.
No.
I was thinking about this in the car recently. I like to think about what is the pleasure center that's being activated when I hear one of those records, like
from the old thing?
Yeah.
Or is it the new thing?
Yeah. Is it like a vestige of my 1995 self?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it some new perspective? And some, I mean, it can be tough to tell the difference.
Both, John. It's a continuity. You can't keep thinking about the present. You got to have an enlarged present, one that goes all the way back to the 1990s.
That was rude.
Nate Chenin, what's one more song from your list that you want to spotlight?
The track Here by Alessia Cara. This was the first song that made me aware of her, and it was, you know, still the one that kind of held fast. It's a song with a really well-developed point of view. She's singing from the perspective of someone who is sort of reluctantly in a space. She's observant. And she's commenting on her position in the space. She's at a party. She doesn't really want to be there. There is a sort of semblance of apology in her lyrics, but she's really not apologizing. You know, it's just a kind of sullen but sensuous commentary, you know. And the singing is fantastic. Her phrasing is really mature. She's sort of slinky with the way that she's working with the melody. And it's a terrific vehicle for her voice. A very youthful idea delivered in a very mature way.
I'm sorry if I seem uninterested, or I'm not listening, or I'm indifferent. Truly, I ain't got no business here. But since my friends are here, I just came to kick it. But really, I would rather be at home all by myself, not in this room with people who don't even care about my well-being. I don't dance, don't ask. Don't need a boyfriend, so you can't go back. Please enjoy your party. I'll be here.
I'll do the opposite. I'll do a very ancient idea delivered in a very ancient way. Bob Dylan singing I'm a Fool to Love You, which is from his album of songs that Sinatra sang. This is the song on the album that Sinatra wrote. This is actually the opposite of your Too Much Fun albums. This is your Too Much Sadness album, but it's also kind of a one-note album. You get kind of tired of it after a while, but this is the song. His voice is not what you would call smooth or suave. The band is playing pretty smoothly, but it's recorded so you can hear all of the amplifiers humming. So you have this wreck of a voice singing about this wreck of a romance with this kind of hushed, reverent band in the background. And it's the song for me that stood out from the album. It's also got a great melody, and I'm kind of happy to hear it again. And Dylan navigates this melody even though he doesn't have much of a voice left. But there are a lot of intervallic leaps in this song that you would not expect Bob Dylan to be negotiating at this point in his career.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true, a love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you.
John Caramonica, what's one more from your list?
I feel like what the people want to hear is a defense of Drip Drop, the song from Empire, but I'm not going to give it to them.
No.
It's so self-evident that I feel like any dissent is just churlish and like I don't even want to entertain it.
No churls here.
Certainly not in this room. So I'm just going to put that out there and then pivot to the next song on my list, which is Poppin' by Rico Ritchie. There is a certain type of song that exists primarily in the universe of New York rap radio mix show, like 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. And like occasionally songs like this like get big, maybe a famous rapper jumps on it and it turns into sort of like a normal rap radio staple. But sometimes they just kind of stay there. This is a song that basically lives in that space, and it has a great hook, a great concept for hook, which is if you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping, which I like completely agree with. It's almost like a life code, certainly a Twitter bio. I think there was a moment a couple months ago where I thought this record might actually kind of catch the wave and turn into something bigger. I feel like it still could happen sometime early next year. But the sheer aggression and attitude of this record spoke to me for the last few months very loudly. And I felt like it would go kind of like unheard or unremarked upon. And therefore, I felt like I wanted to give it a little bit of love.
And now it's popping.
True story.
If you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping. Poppin'. If you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping. If you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping. Poppin'. If you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping. I'm trying to put some money in my pocket. Look good when I drop it, yeah. Can I take out like a rocket? When I get it poppin', you can't stop it, yeah. When I'm in a boost, I'm a boss. When I get started, you can't stop it, you can't stop it.
And I guess I would pick a song by this band that I was paying attention to this year called Ought from Montreal. And it's the song in particular called Beautiful Blue Sky, which was, you know, for all intents and purposes, a single. They're this kind of like slightly dour post-punk young group. There's lots of kind of warning in their songs. But this is a song that has a slow build and it has the dour warnings, but it also has joy and optimism, which comes as this kind of like befuddling element, like, huh? Are you serious? Should I be taking you at face value when you're listening to what the singer is talking about? I thought it was a really extraordinary song, the way it built up slowly and built up its energy. I went to see them once this year. It was so clear that this was their best song. This is as good as this concert is going to get. And sometimes I wish concerts were actually more like that. So just a clear high point for a decent group.
The light coming down over your shoulders. Sam, what is that sensation?
So those are our best songs of 2015. Thanks for listening. Our producers are Tamara Bess and Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can hear a lot of these songs on our Spotify playlist and see our top 10 song lists at nytimes.com/music. Thanks for listening. See you next week.